Hannah Murray on TRE in the afternoon.
Good afternoon. Joining us on the line now is James Hanning, a former deputy editor of The Independent on Sunday. His latest book is The Bookseller of Hay, The Life and Times of Richard Booth. It's a biography of the bookseller and entrepreneur whose drive and vision turned Hay on Wye from a little-known agricultural town into a global books capital and home of a world-famous literary festival. Welcome to the show, James.
Thank you, Hannah. Good to be with you.
Oh, it's great to have you with us. So what made you want to tell the story about the life of Richard Booth?
Well, it's funny. As you say, Hay is kind of world famous now for its literary festival, and it brings in about 200,000 people every year. But what very few of the people one sees queuing for the big marquees, what very few of them know is that actually Hay became famous as a what's now called a book town long before the festival. And it was this extraordinary man called Richard Booth who set up his first shop in the early 60s. And within 15 years, he was running, and it's a tiny town, and it's I can't exaggerate how agricultural and quiet and, dare I say, sleepy it is. But he set up his bookshop in the early 60s, and within 15 years, it was the largest secondhand bookshop in the world. And it wasn't, you know, it wasn't in Piccadilly in central London or anything like that. It was in this really remote place where the railway line had just closed, and, you know, and people sort of said, nobody buys books in Hay. What on earth is he doing? And yet, just by force of personality, the place sort of took off. It was extraordinary. And then the festival came along. Well, over 25 years later, so and the festival grew kind of on the shoulders, as it were, of what Booth had achieved.
Yeah, amazing. So, when did you first come across him? When were you aware of him and what he'd done?
Well, I was very fortunate because I was brought up in London, but my parents bought a tiny, tiny cottage just outside Hay in the 60s, and I used to spend my school holidays there. So I was kind of vaguely aware of him, and my parents, as I say, were mostly in London, and they felt rather guilty at having this empty cottage. So my father asked my mother to see if she could find anyone who would live in the cottage when we weren't there. And she found this very eccentric chap who was working for Richard Booth. And he used to come round when we were down there. And he used to tell these extraordinary stories of what Richard Booth had done. And he was really strange, Booth. And I just grew up. So I grew up with these stories. And then Booth wrote his own book about 25 years ago. And it doesn't begin to convey the madness. I mean, people said, the number of people who said, oh, yeah, it was mad. It was like Bedlam working for him. And yet, you know, it became sort of world famous. It was extraordinary.
Gosh. So, I mean, he made it work somehow then, didn't he?
Well, he did. He was a terrible, terrible businessman. He overspent. He didn't pay a lot of his suppliers. He used to go around the States. One guy who used to work with Booth and then left him and went to work for somebody else, when he turned up at one very big and famous bookshop in the States, the shopkeeper, when he saw this guy arrive, he went to the back of the shop and got his shotgun out because he thought he was still working for Richard Booth. And he said, you know, you haven't paid your bills. And he said, I'm not working for him anymore. Don't blame me. He was a terrible payer. And but yeah, very, very very charismatic in a way, but quite unusual.
Yeah. So was he ambitious then? Did he want to have the biggest secondhand bookshop in the world? Did he want to create this massive festival that became such a big deal? Was he really ambitious?
Well, funnily enough, actually, he opposed the setting up of the festival because he thought it was all about new books. And he said, you know, our thing is secondhand books. But no, when he set up in the 60s, I mean, his parents were very straight-laced and conventional. And he'd left Oxford without a degree. They wanted him to either join the army or be an accountant or a lawyer or do something respectable. And he was just a rebel and he didn't want to do that. And to get them off his back, he kind of said, oh, I'm setting up a bookshop. And a chap gave him sort of favorable terms to set up this shop. And so he sort of fell into it, and it wasn't actually a bookshop initially. It was a sort of knick-knack shop and antiques and stuff. But then he realized that a lot of the Welsh mining villages were closing their libraries, so he could go and get a lot of cheap books, and they wanted to get rid of their books. And so he used to go down in a van and just to help himself. And he got them at very cheap rates. And then he just sold them, and he realized that he was bringing people into town. So he just accelerated and accelerated. And he worked very, very hard. But it was sort of the inspiration kind of struck him almost by accident. It wasn't that he started out trying to create this great empire.
And when he first bought the bookshop, was it a lot smaller? Was he constantly buying bigger premises, or was it big from the start?
Yes, that's right. That's right. It's a very small shop. If you ever visit Hay, there's a pub called the Blue Boar, and the first shop was opposite that, and it was tiny. I mean, really, really tiny. But he realised, as I say, that books seemed to be what was selling. And also, I mean, the other great thing he had in his favour was that property there, you know, it was a very, very rundown place, and property was really cheap. So he could go off and buy enormous quantities of books, and he had plenty of storage space where it cost very little. So, and gradually he bought up more and more shops in Hay and filled them up with all these books. And as I say, it was just force of personality, and he employed more and more people. And then as the 60s and 70s went on, the fact that a lot of people were coming to his bookshops meant that more bookshop owners were attracted to the place. So he brought new shop, you know, he attracted more shops into the town. And it became a huge thing by the mid-70s.
Yeah. And was he picking up any rare books? Were people travelling for miles in order to go to the bookshop, or was it not like that?
Well, first of all, he attracted students from Oxford, and he used to offer them discounts. I think he used to hire a bus and sort of bus people in from Oxford, and he would give if a student could bring five friends, he would then get his books free or whatever.
Gosh.
So that was the way of bringing in the numbers. And it was that old thing of serendipity. You know what it's like in a bookshop. You go in and you're looking for something, and then you think, oh, there's something else. And, of course, they were very cheap. So people would go in looking for one book, and they'd come out with a great armful of stuff. and so it was a lot of it was kind of, you know, pretty cheap, nothing special. But he did also come across some pretty valuable stuff, which he sometimes sold very well and sometimes sold very, very badly, actually, and he sold it for much less than it was worth.
And was he, throughout his career with the bookshop, was he always opposed to new books then? Did he never want to go there?
Yeah, that's right. He said, he used to say, new books are for the ego, secondhand books are for the intellect. And he didn't like the idea of the festival, partly because he was quite an egotist, and he kind of thought he was literally king of the castle. I mean, he bought the town's castle, and he lived there, and he crowned himself king. And so he didn't like people encroaching on what he regarded as his sort of fiefdom. So when there was talk of setting up the festival, he was very opposed to it. And he didn't like new books. He didn't sell new books himself. He thought it would become sort of corporate and be all about, you know, publishers trying to sell their wares. And there are people who say that's what the festival is now. I mean, it is about that, but it's about rather more than that. But certainly he was vindicated by his own lights in that respect. And also, the festival got sponsorship from Rupert Murdoch in its early days. And he was very opposed to Murdoch and that sort of big money thing. And he said, no, this is different. We don't want all that sort of stench of big money. Mm. So he was really very childish and very opposed to the festival. He used to hire people with chainsaws to rev up their chainsaws outside poetry reading for so people couldn't hear the
That's
readings.
That's terrible.
It's extraordinary, yeah.
So over the years, he never got involved with the festival then?
Well, this being Booth, actually, yes, of course he did. Eventually, when he had his own book to promote, About 10 years after it set up, he actually said, oh, all right, then I'll go. And he went and promoted his own book. And his friends all said, look, come on, Richard, this is being a bit childish. You know, the festival is here to stay. You've got to, you know, you've got to drop this kind of ego-driven obstruction of the festival. So he did sort of join in, but he never embraced it, you know, wholly. And he called the boss of the festival, who is not particularly tall, he called him Little Napoleon. And he just, you know, he was a bit of a wind-up merchant, I'm afraid.
So is the bookshop still going today?
Yeah, there are still over 40 book outlets in Hay. I mean, it's a very thriving place. And a lot of people thought, oh, well, when Richard dies, he died 6 years ago. And actually his sort of empire, his own empire had declined considerably by then. You know, the banks had sort of caught up with him a bit. But no, Hay remains a sort of mecca for, you know, notwithstanding the festival and, you know, what I've just said about new books, Hay still attracts a lot of people buying secondhand books. And there are over 40 booksellers represented in Hay. There must be probably 20 bookshops and then 20 more people who sort of share venues and so on. So it's still a sustainable thing. And it didn't just collapse after Richard died.
Mm. It must have been fascinating looking into his life and career and finding out what he was really like, was it?
Well, it was. I mean, yeah, Hay is a tiny place. I mean, it's 40, population is about 1,400 people. And he had three wives, and everyone thought they knew him very well. But there were loads of stories I uncovered which people didn't know. And I mean, he had three wives. His second wife he abandoned at the altar
when he discovered
she was a cocaine addict.
Oh, gosh.
I mean, just extraordinary stuff. He also attracted some quite famous people. Marianne Faithfull went to live in Hay for a bit. Someone called April Ashley, who had a gender reassignation operation in the early 60s. She went to live in Hay. He was a great publicist, self-publicist, as it were. So he was very good at attracting people who the media would want to talk about. He would be called, I think, an influencer these days.
Yeah.
Just because he was quite charismatic and completely shambolic as well. I mean, he looked an absolute mess. He always had soup branded down his jumper and tied his trousers up with sort of bailer string. So, yeah, he was not a kind of a silver-tongued smoothie at all.
No, what a character. And you've got a couple of lovely quotes for the book. Marianne Faithfull, as you mentioned, she said, what you have to understand is that Richard Booth was completely mad.
Yes, that's right. That's right. Yes, I was lucky enough to see her just a few months before she died. And there was a lot of speculation about whether they'd actually had an affair or not. And Well, you'll have to buy the book if you want to know the answer to that.
Yes. And some nice words from Stephen Fry as well about the book.
Yes. Wasn't that amazing? I mean, I was so excited when he said that. It was very, very generous. The thing I didn't really get into was whether Richard was, it'd be called neurodiverse these days. I mean, I think he was, I don't know if he had ADHD or Asperger's or autism of some sort, but he had a lot of the characteristics that I think people associate with some of those conditions.
Yeah.
But I just didn't feel, I felt that was very deep waters and I'm not qualified in that world. So I kind of left it to others if they want to pass a view on that. But I know Stephen Fry is very interested in all that. And I was slightly wondering what his take was on all that.
And did he ever have any children? Has he left any family behind?
No, he didn't. And I mean, there were lots of rumours when I first started doing the book. People say, oh, you know, he's got a family off in so-and-so and so on. But no, he didn't. And that's actually a bit of a mystery. I mean, people said, oh, you know, he had a vasectomy. Well, I don't think he did. I did actually read his diary. His widow, his third wife, who's a lovely woman called Hope. She allowed me to look at his diaries, and I went through those as carefully as I could. His writing was terrible, actually, but it's not clear if he did have a vasectomy or. But I he was certainly unable to have children. But it wasn't clear if that was. Well, you know, you probably don't want me to go into too many details, but if that was a, you know, he had a condition, or whether he'd actually made a decision.
Yeah. It must be very strange reading someone else's diaries, quite intimate and personal.
Yes. Well, I did feel a bit of a voyeur, and actually there are some bits that I thought maybe the reader doesn't need to know this, but you know, they're a bit too personal.
Yeah.
But it did give a bit of an insight. I mean, he worked. I mean, I've said he was a bit of a, I didn't use this word, I think, but he was a bit of a slob. And you might think, oh, that sort of person is quite lazy, but he absolutely wasn't. He was incredibly hardworking. He used to get up at sort of 4 or 5 a.m. and go off buying books. He used to drive up to sort of Newcastle and Manchester and come back, you know, by 5 o'clock. I mean, he really worked very, very hard, you know, getting stock in. And the importance he placed on all that was very clear in the diaries. I mean, he said, oh, yes, we had a good buy in up in Leeds or wherever it was. There was quite a lot of insight there.
And do you know where he got the books from?
Well, it's funny. It always amuses me that. Yeah, he started off getting books from. He used to look at the obituaries pages in the newspapers.
Clever.
And he would ask his staff to write to the widows or the bereaved husband or wife, and say, "Well, actually, funnily enough, we'll be in your area in a couple of weeks' time. You know, do." Is it possible you might have any books to sell? And very often that paid dividends. He used to tell his staff, don't bother with terraced houses and houses which have numbers, street numbers. only go for houses which are called, you know, treetops or the cedars, or, you know, i.e. detached houses.
Yeah.
And the other rule he had was, don't go anywhere near houses which have electrified doorbells. you know, those electric light doorbells, because those sort of people don't read books.
Wow.
Which is, And then as things went on, he would go and buy, you know, whole libraries, and he would go to the States and buy just enormous quantities of books, thousands of books at a time, and ship them back to Hay. And of course, most American dealers were just completely bemused by this.
Yeah.
And couldn't understand it. But most of his staff were kept busy unloading these enormous great lorries. He called them galleons, which were unloaded in the car park in Hay. And then these smaller vans would take them off and they'd get sorted by his rather put upon staff.
Yeah.
Although, say, he's put upon staff, they were, by and large, they were very loyal to him, actually. I mean, he could be very capricious and difficult, but most of them just said, oh, that's just Richard, you know, that's what he's like. He's underneath it, he's a sweetheart.
Mm. And was he picky with the books? I mean, if he was getting a whole collection, would he just take the lot, or would he kind of go through them and say, oh, no, I don't want that one. No, we won't take that one. Or did he
One of the expressions he would always use is, I'll take the lot. And I spoke to a lot of American dealers who just said they couldn't believe it. He wouldn't go through the stuff properly. He'd just say, yeah, I'll take the lot and, you know, get his driver to come in and load the stuff up. And, you know, he was not careful. He was not picky at all. It was quite strange. And it was almost, you know, quantity is more important than quality, which is why he needed to say. I mean, he had a terrible cash flow problem a lot of the time. And he used to do what booksellers called chop it out. Chopping it out is when you just take any offer because you want the cash. So he sold a lot of stuff, particularly antiquarian books, actually.
Yeah.
He sold a lot less than they were worth, just because he always needed the cash, and the banks were always on his back saying, you know, you owe us X thousand.
I've just had a fascinating message, James, from one of our listeners, Angela, who says, listening to the gentleman talking about Richard and Hope Booth, I knew them as they were clients of mine here. They owned an apartment in Marbella, which I managed for them. He was the most eccentric gentleman, intriguing. Hope is almost blind, apparently.
Yes, she is. She is. Gosh, how interesting.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah, no, they used to go to Spain in January because... Well, A, because hay in the winter is absolutely freezing, he said with feeling. but also Hope's eyesight has got worse and worse over time. And the light down there in southern Spain, which I must say must be lovely at this time of year, the light is obviously much better. So, you know, she found things a bit easier. But no, I'm afraid her eyesight is, I mean, I haven't spoken to her for a couple of months, but... Her eyesight is not good at all, I'm afraid.
No. Well, it's been lovely to chat with you, James. Thank you so much for joining us. If listeners want to get a copy of The Bookseller of Hay, The Life and Times of Richard Booth, it's available on our website, tre.radio, and it's by James Hanning, who we've been chatting with. James, thank you so much.
Great. Thank you, Hannah. Good to talk to you.